The smell of a new junk food cinema episode. That's just about the finest smell in the world, except maybe for pastries.
Pastries.
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Ladies and gingerbreads, start your engines. It's time for another high-octane episode of Junk Food Cinema. This is FSR's weekly cult and exploitation film podcast, fueled by geeky affinity, and one that always leaves irony in the dust. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, Internet Gadfly, and I am joined by my friend and cohort... Cohort? Novelist slash screenwriter, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi, everybody.
Professional cohort.
Cohort.
I want to remind you that this very totally professional podcast is available on iTunes. If you just search Junk Food Cinema in the podcast section, while you're there, why not give us a 5-star rating and leave a review? That would be very nice of you. We are also available on Stitcher. You can find us on Twitter. You can follow us at what? Junk Food Cinema. You can also find us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And please use those Amazon links we will have at the bottom of the page. Even if you don't buy that item, if you get to Amazon via our links, anything you purchase benefits us and we appreciate it. So this week, we are talking about something very near and dear to my heart. And as somebody, and Cargill can obviously very much appreciate this, as somebody who has to deal with Austin traffic on a daily basis, there's no shortage of instances where I don't find myself, my mind wandering and thinking about all of the greatest killer car movies of all time. Because it's a bizarre subgenre in film. It's kind of a, I guess, an offshoot of that fear we all have about technology. Basically, the fear that machines will one day rise up and take over. And killer car movies are sort of the fuel-injected version of that fear.
And I think on top of that, we have to deal with the fact that, you know, that cars are inherently dangerous.
True.
That a lot of people do die every year unintentionally. So anyone who would intentionally want to do it.
It makes the vehicle that much scarier when you think about the fact that, yes, people die accidentally in motor vehicles all the time. So the idea that one is malevolent and actually pursuing the death of a human being is just an amplification of a daily peril that we live with. And that's the exciting and awesome intro to our discussion of killer cars. Man, we kind of opened on a downer there. Sorry about that.
Way to bring us down, Brian.
But you know what'll bring us up is talking about these movies. This quintet of amazing killer car films.
Strange collection of movies with all the same basic plot, but all interesting different mythologies behind them or different ways of going about making the movie.
Absolutely. So the one I want to start with is a film called Duel. Now, Duel is interesting. Just the inception of Duel and the names behind it is interesting enough a story. Duel was a 1971 made-for-TV movie that was based on a story by Richard Matheson, who, if you're not familiar with Richard Matheson, wrote all of the best episodes of The Twilight Zone and is responsible for the book I Am Legend that has been translated into a number of different films, from The Last Man on Earth with Vincent Price to The Omega Man to...
Well, and he's, yeah, no, to, yeah, the to Will Smith I Am Legend, yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, and he, but the thing is about Matheson is Matheson's one of those guys, he just recently passed, I want to say last year.
It was very recently.
He wrote a number of books and a number of short stories that were adapted into films. And there's well over a dozen films that are his. And we should probably just go and do an episode of all the things that were based on his. Duel was one of them. I know, damn it. Stir of Echoes is one that, one of those great horror movies that sadly got ignored because it came out right after The Sixth Sense. and just kind of faded away. But that was also based on a short story of his. And and he was so good. And Duel is one of those great big screen, or well, actually small screen adaptations of his work.
And it's funny because so Richard Matheson writes the story. 1971, this film is directed by Steven Spielberg. This is a very early Steven Spielberg film that I feel like most people don't even know is in the canon of Steven Spielberg. And the way that it was created is that Richard Matheson wrote this story after he was being tailgated. This very odd story where he was being tailgated by a truck on the day that John F. Kennedy was assassinated. And just because if it's one of those things that like everybody remembers where they were, it cemented in his head this memory of being tailgated by this sort of ruthless, you know, person on the highway, this semi-truck, that he writes the story that ends up published in Playboy magazine. And in 1971, just some random day, Steven Spielberg's secretary has read the story and brings it to his attention and says, you may want to look into this. And Bob's your uncle. He ends up making the TV movie Duel, which is just about a guy who cuts off a semi and spends the next several hours of his life being chased, hounded by this semi that could at any moment just run him off the road and kill him, but it toys with him. The whole movie, it just really plays this bizarre game of cat and mouse that pushes this main character to the brink. And to kind of emphasize the fact that this could is a universal experience that could happen to anybody, Dennis Weaver, who plays the main character, his name is David Mann. Literally, his last name is Mann. To kind of emphasize that this is something that we all deal with on the road. Like, at any moment in our travels, we could come across this complete psychopath.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that in this movie, we never see the driver.
Well, and that is a trope that then will follow with several of the movies that we talk about, but becomes a big trope of a number of films in which you have this menace that it doesn't matter what the menace, who the menace is or what their motivations are. Mm-hmm. It's just the menace. And in fact, the way this movie is structured and the way it's set up, Spielberg would then rip himself off and use a number of those elements in his first huge hit, Jaws.
Jaws, yeah. No, there are a lot of moments in this film where you can see Spielberg auditioning almost like working out the kinks or beta testing these ideas that would later become, you know, the tenets of Jaws. And I love that about it. But again, it's just you have this the semi truck itself has all of these different. It's a very subtle touch. At first, you don't really notice it because it's just an old semi, but it has all these license plates in the front grille. Not just one license plate, not just one type of license plate, but several. And you start to realize as the movie goes on, those are scalps. Yeah. Those are other cars that this truck has done this to. And when you figure that out, when that hits, like, right in the middle of him just fucking with this guy, it becomes a whole other ballgame, and it really becomes super sinister, and I love that about it.
Yeah. It's one of the classics. It is an iconic movie that I've heard a number of pitches. In fact, there's one movie that a friend of mine is making right now, which he pitched as Duel with a UFO. And it's just like, holy crap, I want to see that fucking movie. And I've heard a number of pitches over time. It's Duel with this or Duel with that. Jaws was Duel with a shark. And it really has become, I'm glad we started with this one because this is the mother of all killer car movies. Like this is the one that every other one aspires to and is still a really great movie. I mean, it's one of those that you can show to people and it's so white knuckle tense and it's so good.
And it's so simple.
And yeah, but if you look at how Spielberg put it together, he actually had in his office a huge map of the highway where they were tracking where each thing was happening. So like they, a lot of care went into this. This is a young Spielberg who's brilliant and hungry. And there's so many little flourishes in this movie of a really hungry future legend trying to prove himself and cut his teeth on this TV movie.
And I love the fact that Spielberg thinks of this. I mean, we've gotten to a point, like you said, where we think Duel with A or Duel with this. Spielberg thought of this as High Noon on Wheels. That was how he conceived of the film. And I love so many incredible takes on High Noon, not the least of which being Outland, yeah, which takes a sci-fi element to it. I really love kind of that. That's that along with Seven Samurai are my two favorite movies to see in other iterations. So the fact that Spielberg considers this High Noon on Wheels is so telling of why it works so well. And the fact that Spielberg shot this in 13 days. Like, you watch this movie and it's like, yeah, he shot this entire film in 13 days.
Yeah.
And it works so well. And there's nothing about it. I think there's a stigma with TV movies that you expect a certain type of quality, or you expect, I don't know, a certain inferiority, I guess, when you're dealing with a TV movie. There is nothing even remotely, quote unquote, TV movie about this. I mean, it feels like a contained film, but there's nothing about it that feels neutered or overly restrained.
It's cinema. It's shot like cinema. You know, one of the things about TV is that you don't, in fact, I was just discussing this with a friend about why he was madly in love with the show Hannibal, and the fact that Hannibal does something you don't see on a lot of TV shows, which is insert shots and a lot of coverage on things, because you don't have time for coverage. And so you do everything, you know, in as few shots as possible. But this is a cinema movie. This is a movie that was shot like a film, not like a TV movie. And so it was done in a very different way. And so it doesn't have that feel of a TV movie, something that just a bunch of jobbers got together and knocked out because it was supposed to kill time and show once as a movie of the week on a network.
Yeah, and it's funny, in Europe it did actually get a theatrical release. In Europe it was a film they released in theaters. It wasn't something they showed on TV.
Well, that was something we saw a lot in the 70s. I remember, you know, the pilot of Buck Rogers was actually released in European cinemas. So was Battlestar Galactica. They were released as movies. We just never got them here, which is unfortunate. I would have loved to have seen those on the big screen as a kid.
Yeah. And this is a movie that thankfully anymore is not hugely difficult to find. I think the DVD is still very much in circulation. And
oh, yeah.
I saw this movie, actually, I was going through this phase where I was very, not even experimental is not even the right word, but I was just very hungry to see as many different films that I could that I hadn't heard of. And I was living in Baton Rouge and using their actually decently well-stocked library system. And I came across this movie and it just blew my mind. Not only because it was Matheson and Spielberg, but because it was just such a well-done movie, such a very simple but incredibly well-executed film that played to a fear that I still to this day have. I don't like semis. I don't like driving on the highway and being between two semis. I don't like, I just, they make me nervous. Or like when you have like a three-lane highway and, you know, you're in maybe the far right lane and a semi comes from the far left lane to the middle lane. Every time I see that, I always think that it's about to smash into me. It's like this irrational fear I have of semis. So I think it played in very well to that. But from 1971's Duel, we go to pre-Jaws Duel to post-Jaws 1977 with The Car.
Evil has visited the Earth in many forms. Now it returns as The Car.
Which I maintain is the best of the Jaws ripoffs ever made. And it's so criminally underseen, this film, which takes place out in the desert. I believe it's in New Mexico, or maybe it's Utah. I can't remember exactly, but out in just sort of the picturesque American West.
Yeah, like it's Arizona or New Mexico. It's one of those in the middle of nowhere the places. And it's such a weird place to want to shoot something like that.
Yeah.
And yet, man, does it work.
Yeah, absolutely. Because you would think if you were making a movie that is going to sort of owe its existence and really play upon the tropes of Jaws, you wouldn't go with a movie that has wide open spaces. I mean, part of the thing about Jaws that makes it so primeval is that we can't see into the ocean. The ocean is one of those great vast unknowns, and so much of it is hidden from us. And that's why Jaws works so well, is because the shark is just sort of the emblem of that fear of the unknown and the things we can't see, we can never understand.
It could be right beneath us and we have no idea.
Exactly. In The Car, it is just a wide open expanse of a desert. And yet they're going after, and for my money, achieving a lot of the same effect. So the basic story of The Car is that James Brolin, just baby-faced, charming as all get out James Brolin, is the sheriff in this small town. It's like really small town, like five other guys, and you know, encompasses the entire police force. And you know, he's got two daughters. He's from a previous marriage. He's got this girlfriend. Everything's going great, but then in comes this Lincoln Mark III with a horn like the devil and possibly a similar type of driver. No one can really be sure. But it just starts running people over. And it has some of the most spectacular cinematography I've ever seen in a horror film. The opening shot, the opening kill of the film, are these two people on bikes that are, you know, they're riding bikes across this bridge and they go through a tunnel and this car is just hounding them and honking at them and running into their rear tire. And it sends the one guy completely over this bridge. And this bridge has to be, I don't even know how many stories tall. And the shot of him going over is the camera's at the bottom and he just keeps falling toward the camera in one static shot that never cuts away. I don't see a wire. I don't see, like, to this day, I cannot figure out how they pulled this off. Because it looks like they killed a stuntman. It looks like there's no other outcome possible other than this stuntman's head smashed on the rocks or something. But so throughout the movie, it's just James Brolin trying to figure out who's driving this car, who's doing this, and becoming increasingly more convinced that there is no one driving this car, that the car itself is just pure evil. And that's the great tagline of the movie, of course, is that the car. And like I said, it's the cinematography, I think, that really sets this film apart.
It does. And then it develops a really interesting mythology around the car. And the car becomes genuinely scary.
Yeah.
And that's that, I think, is what also really works with this movie. But I think ultimately it just runs into the problem that, you know, there's a number of killer car movies. And this is often considered to be one of the lesser ones, despite the fact that it's so good.
Yeah.
Like, I don't agree with you that it's one of the best or the best Jaws knockoffs, but it's up there. And it's a really good movie, and it's one that you can pull out and watch, and despite being almost 30 years old. Despite being 35 years old, 30, you know, going on 40, still holds up with its tension and just how raw it is, and is just really, really fucking good.
And there's this great scene. I mean, in terms of just, like, you know, kind of mimicking Jaws, there's this great scene where the camera is tracking through the hills and you see the roof of the car appear and then disappear behind these hills, very much like a shark's fin.
Yeah.
And it's just such a great, like, little reference to, you know, to where it's pulling from. And there's also that scene of, like, how can you let this parade go on when I've warned you that there's, I mean, like, that scene that's in every Jaws knockoff where it's like, there's always, like, the one stalwart government official who's just like, no, I think we'll be fine. And it's like, no, I warned you about this. And just
it's like the scientist from 50s B movies.
Yes.
Where they always run into the general that's obstinate. Well, there's always the town official or the county official or the park ranger that's like, no, we've got much bigger problems than people being killed by some brutal supernatural force or angry bear or angry shark.
I think my favorite one is there's a Jaws ripoff called Blood Beach where the creature isn't in the water, it's under the sand. So it's like this weird Jaws Tremors amalgam, even though it's before Tremors. The reason they won't close the beach in that movie isn't because of any big celebration or any big summer festival. They just haven't filed the right paperwork. There's literally a whole scene in that movie where John Saxon, who plays the sheriff of the town, is like arguing that he did file the right paperwork. And the rest of the committee's like, no, you didn't. And I'm just like, this is a movie. Hooray. But my favorite scene.
Bureaucracy. Dear God, we're being killed by bureaucracy.
You're going to need a bigger filing cabinet. But my favorite scene in the car, and it's this, like, this, I would recommend watching this scene to, I would recommend that people watch the scene who are aspiring cinematographers. Like, this is just, it's a gorgeous shot from start to finish. There's a woman who is making a call, and she's in a, she's basically outsmarted the car a couple of times, and she's out in her home, which is this mobile home, kind of out in the middle of nowhere, and she's talking on the phone, and she's standing, and it's like a warm desert night, and you know you got the wind coming in from outside the open window, and she's standing with her back to the window on the phone, and all of a sudden in the grim distance you just see these two headlights, and there's no sound, you just see the headlights, and the headlights are growing steadily bigger, and you know that she's done for, but there's no sound, it's agonizing. And they shoot it all the way to the end where the car just plows through the building and keeps going. And then they cut back to the trailer and you just see the ruins. And again, there's no sound. There's no dramatic music. It's nothing. You just have to look at it. You just have to stare at the carnage. And it's, again, like just a testament to how the guy that shot this film actually also shot things like Young Frankenstein. So It's an amazing film. You love James Brolin in this film. He's so effortlessly charming. Even the characters who are a little bit more obstinate are likable in this film. They really do a good job of making everyone so folksy and so, I mean, with the exception of BJ Armstrong, who is a character actor who normally plays scumbags.
Yeah.
And does it very well. And he plays a scumbag in this film, but even he kind of has his moment of redemption toward the end. And the finale of this film is just like this infernal showdown between the police and this car in the middle of the desert. And when I say infernal, I mean that entirely.
Oh yeah. No, I mean, this thing turns into a supernatural movie. Like we, you know, this is not Duel. This is not about some guy running around, some serial killer. It's not The Highwayman, which you and I were talking about a little earlier that we're not talking about tonight. The Jim Caviezel Killer Padiddle movie, which
Killer Padiddle.
Yeah. It's not a good movie, but it's,
it is a Killer Padiddle movie.
It is a killer car movie about a guy driving around. You'd think, you know, if you were driving around in a car that you're using to mow down people, you'd get the headlight fixed so you don't get pulled over.
Right?
But no. This killer drives the car that everyone can recognize while he's driving.
In brash defiance of the law.
And brash defiance of logic. but yeah, no, this is a supernatural, scary fucking car of doom.
Yeah, there's this great scene where...
Lincoln Mark III of doom.
There's this great scene where two cop cars are chasing the eponymous car, and it stops and flips itself. I don't know. Again, I don't know how they pulled this shit off in the movie. The car stops, flips itself up, and lands in the windshield of the cop car. Fiery explosion, and then just drives out.
It flips you. Flips you for real.
It flips you for real.
Did you see the pool? They flipped the bitch.
They flipped the bitch. Did you see that car?
See the car? It flips the bitch.
Highly, highly, highly recommend The Car. I still, to this day, I think this is one of the earliest films that I latched onto as a critic and just really beat the drum for, and I will continue to do it until I feel like everyone knows The Car and everyone's like, yes, I've seen it. Shut up.
You know, this is one of those movies that you turned me onto. For all the movies that I've passed to you, you're like, dude, how have you not seen The fucking Car? And I'm like, because it's a movie about a killer car, right? You're like, you need to watch this fucking movie. And I was like, all right, I'll go home and watch it. Me and my wife watch it, and we're like, holy shit, that's why he's losing his mind. Or this is a really good fucking movie.
I'll do it. Stop screaming at me. Okay, I'll watch it anyway.
Say hi to your mother.
Say hi to your mother for me. I don't know why they got Wahlberg.
I don't know why you got Wahlberg all of a sudden, but he came out.
Look, we're going to talk about another movie. It's about a killer car. It's a movie called Christine. What are you going to do? Christine.
One of two Stephen King movies we're talking about tonight.
One of two Stephen King movies. This one directed, of course, by John Carpenter. And it's interesting. It's an interesting film in the oeuvre of John Carpenter. Because it both...
We need an oeuvre alarm now.
Oeuvre alarm. Yeah, scrambled oeuvre. It's both very much a Carpenter film and very different for a Carpenter film.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't resemble all of his other movies, and it does at the same time.
It's
sort of a paradox.
And it comes at a weird time in his career where all of his other films kind of feel like he's evolving towards something. And this one just kind of sticks out like a sore thumb. Like, what are you doing there? And not in a bad way, because it's a good movie. Just like, it almost feels like there was some kind of meddling involved behind the scenes, or that he was playing around with something that was just very different from everything else that he was doing and evolving into. Because you watch him from 79 on, and you see him definitely evolving in style and becoming the John Carpenter we all fell in love with. And this is the John Carpenter movie that most John Carpenter fans kind of forget he did.
Well, and it's funny because this kicks off sort of a completely new direction for Carpenter, because, you know, he did The Thing in 82. And then in 83 comes Christine. And then after that, Starman, Big Trouble in Little China, Prince of Darkness, They Live. A very different era for John Carpenter. Like, he had established himself in almost like cemented the John Carpenter style by the time The Thing had come out. And then this next string of movies, it's like, we can't nail this guy down.
Except that there's a lot of visual tics and things that you see in those other movies that just aren't as prevalent here. Like, it feels and looks like a different Carpenter film, like a different Carpenter.
The thing that is missing from this movie that you find in a lot of Carpenter films, and maybe there is a moment I'm just forgetting, but I watched it very recently, his use of stillness is absent. There's that thing that Carpenter always uses to magnificent perfection is that he can use stillness.
He'll lock off his shot and it in a very Wes Anderson kind of way and just hold it while other stuff is going on.
And the closest we get in Christine are the shots of the car basically rejuvenating itself. But I would argue that there's a lot going on in those scenes that's very kinetic that doesn't really have the same feel. But like you think about the shape standing across the lawn in Halloween. You think about, in the fog, the ghosts in the church, even Big Trouble in Little China, as they're driving away with the girl they've kidnapped from the airport, they're sitting in the front seat of the car. None of those gangsters are moving or saying anything. And they cut to the back seat. And even the girl that's been kidnapped is just kind of laying there as if she's been drugged. Like that stillness is still there, but you don't get that in Christine.
Yeah.
It's a very strange, like I said, it both very much is because the music is unmistakably Carpenter.
Yes.
Unmistakably. And the movie opens up with that same typeface, white text on black background that he used for pretty much every one of his films. So there's a lot that's still very Carpenter, but it's the story of sort of a corruption of the basic American ideal of a young man getting his first car. And it turns that into from something that's very much a part of the American myth into something that's more of a Faustian tale. It's about a boy who's getting his first car that is slowly corrupting him because it is evil. And will not, it forms this unhealthy attachment to him that does not allow for anyone else, one, to get close to him, and God forbid you cross this kid, because Christine will come after you with a vengeance. And in fact, is a 1958 Plymouth Fury, which I thought was such a great choice. One of the interesting things about Christine is that they put this film into production before the book came out.
Yeah,
King was so popular, they were like, oh, he's writing a book about what? Let's go ahead and start the movie.
Yeah, no, this was the era when Stephen King, this is the weird era for Stephen King. For those of you that aren't familiar with King's history, he wrote what may be his five best books right up front and wrote a lot of great books. And then he wrote a lot of his best known books during a period in which he was so popular and people were so demanding. He took on himself this idea that, as he often says, they don't pay you to write books, they pay you to finish. Mm-hmm. And you got to get it done. And it was the early 80s. He fell into coke and drugs and just was writing like a motherfucker and was just cranking out book after book after book and was just going like a madman. And completely forgot that he wrote stuff. He doesn't remember writing Cujo. And this is from that era. And this is one of those things where he had gotten so big and his The Shining had kind of pushed him over to another level that, everybody wanted to make his books into movies sight unseen. And so the manuscripts were going out long before publication. They were making them. And this was one of those.
And another thing that makes this sort of an outlier in the canon of Carpenter is that it uses more pop music than any of his other films. So much of this movie is, and so you get such a sense of what the car is feeling by the music choices. When it kicks on its own radio and starts playing music from the 50s and 60s, you start to understand what it's thinking, and actually benefits the movie quite a bit, because if you watch it, the movie's not very violent. Like, I mean, there's a couple scenes of people getting run over, but in terms of gore and blood, it didn't even have enough of that to secure an R rating. Like, they were worried that as a horror film, just funny if you think about Hollywood now, but at the time they were worried that if a horror film came out and was PG, nobody would go see it, and it wasn't violent enough to get an R rating, so they intentionally went in and added the word fuck a whole bunch to get an R rating. That's how like tame the violence in this movie is. And yet, what I think makes it a really effective horror film are those moments where we actually feel like we're inside the head of the car. We start to understand what the car is thinking, and I think a lot of that is because of the music that he uses.
Well, and that goes back to King. That was part of this era that he was in. He wrote in this particular era, the big things that he did was he wrote Christine, he wrote Cujo, and he wrote Firestarter. And they were the thing those three books all have in common was they were all about getting inside the head of the monster. And, you know, in Firestarter, the monster is a little 8-year-old girl with a power far greater than she can control. In Cujo, you're inside the mind of the dog. And Christine, you're in the mind of the car. And yeah, Carpenter nailed that. I mean, this is Carpenter at his height, in his heyday, before he, you know, he really started experimenting a little too much with drugs and kind of locked himself in this era. He was still really ambitious and still doing really amazing things and really breaking new ground. And how he did that with the music and Christine was just fucking brilliant.
Absolutely. And you know, we can't really talk about this movie without talking about the transformation sequences when the car will get, you know, the bullies will try to destroy the car and it will kind of like, it's all dented and dinged and smashed up and it just kind of like puffs itself back out. And apparently the way they did that is they created a sort of plastic version of the car that looked metal. They put a hydraulic pump in it, turned it on, which kind of sucked all the plastic inward, and then they just shot it and they just played it in reverse. But it's such an amazing effect to watch in the movie that all these dented fenders just like popping themselves back out and the car just completely repairing itself. And I love the fact that King is, you know, and this is just from the very limited amount of exposure I've had to King's books, but more in his movies, is obsessed with the 50s. He has this thing for the 1950s.
The 50s and the early 60s is when he was a kid.
Yeah. It's like he considers that to be the scariest time in our history because so many of his stories aren't just about the 50s, but specifically about ghosts of the 50s kind of finding their way back. Like sometimes they come back, for example, about the dead greasers who like, you know.
Keep in mind that, you know, to him, the 50s were 25, 30 years ago, the way the 80s are to us.
Sure.
And he was looking back at the nostalgia of that era that he grew up in the same way that, you know, you and I do. And so he was looking at the rose colored glasses of what that was and introducing us to it. And yeah, he wrote an awful lot about that era, throughout. It's one of those things. It's like people like to point out, you know, if we went and remade Back to the Future now, we'd be going back to the 80s.
Yeah.
It really is one of those things that was something he was obsessed with. He and his family are also obsessed with killer cars.
Right.
But it's funny, you know, as we're doing this, we're sitting next to, you know, the bookshelf in the office that has Joe Hill, his son's book Nosferatu, also about a killer car. The next film we'll talk about will end up being a Stephen King killer car movie.
Yeah. And I just wanted to touch on this thing though, specifically about how his feeling about the 50s plays into Christine, is that the 50s and the whole like baby boom era and this very idealized America and almost everything about American culture in the 1950s that is so revered and looked upon as this idyllic American existence revolves around cars.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that he's actually taken that existence. He's taken the sort of the paradigm of American culture and made that the villain. Made a Detroit-made muscle car the vessel of evil. And that to me is just such a – just like a knife in the eye of what the purest American dream is.
Yeah.
And I love that about it.
Well, and that was always what was great about him was he's really good at taking truly idyllic things and then making them truly horrific and showing the seedy corruption underneath.
Which is why so many of his books have, you know, protagonists that are kids.
Yeah.
Because it's, again, it's just kind of the corruption of the ideal. But speaking of Stephen King, we talk about Stephen King in very favorable lights here. And now we're going to talk about Maximum Overdrive.
Now we're going to talk about the very weird Stephen King that had the audacity.
The balls on this fucking guy.
Oh, okay. So where you have to start talking about Maximum Overdrive.
Which I should mention, you know, before we get into this, I should mention is a movie I like very much.
Oh, no. I like it a lot, too. It is a wonderful bad movie that is so inventive and has really good merits to it. But the balls in this fucking guy, the teaser trailer has him that first came out. And this is how many of us were introduced in the 80s. Stephen King walks out. We recognize him. He had just done this big commercial for for American Express, which is the one thing in his career he really regrets, because he came out on national television and was like, I'm Stephen King. People know my name, but they don't always recognize me. And so that's why I carry the American Express card. And so I get treated like I deserve to be treated, you know, however the thing went. And so everybody now, for the first time, we put a face to the name. And everybody's seen him on television, and he walks out and he's like,
a lot of people have directed Stephen King novels and stories.
And we're sitting there going, yeah, like The Fucking Shining, like Christine, like Firestarter, like Carrie, like, and you just start naming off all these great things. And he goes,
and I finally decided if you want something done right, you ought to do it yourself.
You've got to do it yourself.
Really, King?
And it was like,
really?
Holy shit.
Let me run down the short
balls
list.
That guy.
Let me run down
moment.
The short list of directors who at this point had directed King adaptations. Brian De Palma, Stanley Kubrick, George Romero, David Cronenberg, and as we just discussed, John Carpenter. So Stephen King, who had never directed a movie in his life, gets up in front of God and everyone else and says, I can make a better movie than Brian De Palma, Stanley Kubrick, George Romero, David Cronenberg, or John Carpenter. The fucking
the balls of this guy. Oh my God. Yeah, and then the movie he makes is not a pimple on the ass of any of those movies. Like, just not.
Which, like, again, I still
it's,
like
it's
very
better
much.
Than Firestarter.
It's still better than Firestarter. I would agree with that very much.
So
Maximum Overdrive is, you know, when we started this discussion, we started talking about the idea that all of these killer car movies in some fashion are splinters of the fear that someday the machines are going to rise up and take over. And that's exactly what this movie is about. It's not just vehicles, in fact, but all machines. From, you know, ATMs to soda machines are out to get us.
And so what happens is, speaking, you know, we've already mentioned Romero. Mm-hmm. And Romero's a good friend of his at this point. And so what he does is he makes a really inventive knockoff of Romero and makes Night of the Living Dead with machines.
Yes.
And that's the movie.
Night of the Living Dead batteries.
Yeah. It's all of everything mechanical goes nuts and starts trying to kill us. And so all of these people end up holding up and are trapped at this truck stop, being menaced by the machines and this really, really cool, oddball looking tractor trailer.
Yeah. This truck for a toy company that has. It's the Green Goblin.
It's the Green
Spider-Man.
Goblin. There was something, and I'm blanking on this now, but there was something else they really wanted, and they wanted something really recognizable and could not get the rights to it or something. I think it might have been a Cabbage Patch doll or something weird. And so what they ended up with was using the Green Goblin because they could get the rights to that. And because Marvel wasn't huge at the time. They were just still up and coming. They were still having, you know, I don't think this was the point where they had financial problems yet, but so they've got the Green Goblin, and that becomes, that's the image of the movie. Like, yeah. If you remember anything from that movie, you remember the Green Goblin on the front of the tractor trailer.
Yeah. And like we said, it's every machine starts coming to life and killing. And speaking of balls, there's a scene in this movie where during a Little League game, a steamroller comes bursting onto the field and just runs this kid over. A kid. Yeah. It's just like, holy shit.
There's a story Stephen King tells about that, in which he had shot that scene. And on the first take of that scene, what they did is they've got this fake body of this that the steamroller goes over. And they had put this blood in the head so that when it ran over, it would pop a little and the blood would, you know, you'd see that it was blood and it would gross everybody out. But they'd put too much in it and the steamroller generated too much pressure. And the first take of it, the head swelled up like a balloon, which was like,
oh man.
And splattered everywhere. And he took that daily. He was so proud of it. He took that daily and he sent it to George Romero, who reportedly threw up. Like, it was like so grotesque. He watched it and he threw up. And Stephen King was like, yes, I know what I'm doing. And so that is not the shot, as I understand it, that's in the movie. I would love to kind of see what made George Romero throw up.
Yeah, right.
But it is just an odd duck ballsy little movie.
And at the heart of it is this sweaty, just deplorable truck stop story that it has the same amount of like grit and grime to it as Emilio Estevez in Repo Man. Like, it's just a filthy, sweltering truck stop where Pat Hingle is just this corrupt cigar-chomping asshole who hires all these ex-cons and then makes them work longer hours than they report in for, or he'll send them back to jail, and everything's just like, then there's this Bible salesman who can't stop touching girls, and it's just like, it's a filthy fucking truck stop.
Well, that was very King, and it was very King in the 80s. One of the things that King always excelled at was creating oddball characters that would be really interesting stories on their own, and characters that would rivet you in a drama, which is why, you know, the dramas he's written are so good as well. But then when you put them in horror movies, he creates characters that you really either loathe or love. Yeah. And he does that here. He creates this really loathsome guy and these guys you really feel for who are stuck already in a shit situation. And then shit gets worse when some kind of Russian satellite activates everything on the planet that might not be a Russian satellite, but might be aliens, you know. We don't fucking know, because he totally ripped it off from Romero, the little shrug of an ending, like, I don't know what caused it. It doesn't matter. They came to life. What are you going to do?
And then, of course, we have to talk about that AC/DC soundtrack.
Fuck, yes, we do.
Just the whole movie is AC/DC. And, of course, it kicks off with that great song, Who Made Who. Which is just, it is the perfect establishing song for the entire movie. And it precedes a scene where the machines turn on a drawbridge while all these cars are on it. And it looks like Stephen King just playing with Matchbox cars, just throwing cars at other cars. I mean, it's nothing more sophisticated than that. It's like, I'm going to drop this truck off a bridge, and I'm going to throw that truck at this one. And Stephen King has admitted that he was so coked out of his mind the entire time he was making the movie that he didn't know most of the time what he was doing, and has said, you know, I'd really like to try that again sober. And I'm like, I don't know. Like,
he had a really, I mean, we've mentioned it kind of in passing, because this whole era, this dictated who he was, and he cleaned himself up and got his shit together, and then looks on his lost years. But in his lost years, he put out so much fucking shit that it's not like you just go, oh, well, yeah, I really, you know, I lost a couple years to drinking. It was like, holy shit, I directed a movie. Yeah. And I wrote like best-selling books, and how the fuck did I do that?
Yeah. Meanwhile, I just forget where my keys are.
Yeah. And we know about this because he wrote about it in his book, On Writing, which is, you know, he came clean about it. It was just like, yeah, look, this, don't do this.
There's, as you know, as much as we love this movie, which we unironically do, I enjoy the hell out of this movie. It's just so brazen and so much fun at the same time. And like I said, really kind of speaks to that underlying fear that all of us have, even if we don't want to admit that someday we're going to our reach is going to exceed our grasp of technology and we're going to lose control. But I will say that there's a great quote from Stephen King when people ask him, why didn't you direct a movie after Maximum Overdrive? His go-to quote is, just watch Maximum Overdrive. That is his answer to that question. And, you know, I think Emilio Estevez is like, he's still very much, you know, in his prime, and this is a great role for him. And you got that very iconic Green Goblin truck, and just all of these creative and darkly comedic ways, like the soda machine that fires a can into a guy's skull and kills him, or the ATM that just says fuck you over and over again to Stephen King himself in a cameo, to the rocking AC/DC music, which is some of the first music I think I ever heard. My dad was is a huge AC/DC fan, and I think that's probably the albums I got to know earliest in my formative years were, you know, AC/DC, Razor's Edge, and so forth. So I love Maximum Overdrive. It's probably the silliest movie on this list.
Easily.
But it's still a lot of fun, and I still think there is an ample amount of quality, even if its director was coked out of his mind and had the balls to basically say, I'm going to make a better film than Stanley Cooper.
Yeah, last time I saw this was at Top Notch. Top Notch, oh, nice. During the summer. Top Notch, for those of you that don't know, you may recognize the name of it. It's where Richard Linklater shot scenes from Dazed and Confused.
All right.
Yeah, it's the place where the very first shot of the very first scene that Matthew McConaughey ever starred in was shot. And it's this great little family-owned burger joint a few blocks away from where we live. And during the summer, once a month, they have classic car nights where people come out with their classic cars and they park them, and you can walk around and look at all of these just cherry amazing vehicles that are, you know, sometimes 50 and 60 years old, if not older. And then they show a movie after dark, and they try to show some kind of car movie. And the last time I went to that the auto night was last summer, and they showed Maximum Overdrive. And so I sat, you know, in the parking lot eating top-notch burgers and fries and watching Maximum Overdrive with a bunch of car nuts. And it was just a hell of a lot of fun. And it was, and this is one of those movies that isn't meant to be enjoyed alone. It's meant to be enjoyed with other people so that you can enjoy the silliness and strangeness of it, but then really get into the moments that really do work, like the fucking steamroller scene.
Absolutely. And closing out our killer car movie here, this one might be, it's a bit of a stretch, but not entirely. And that is 1986's The Wraith.
An evil force took his life. An unearthly power has brought him back. He is a phantom, a wraith, a cosmic spirit given another chance.
Now, The Wraith is a film that, you know, on paper, you might look at and go, you know, why would anybody watch this? This seems like, you know, silly dreck that they trotted out to get the teen market in the 80s. It stars Charlie Sheen. It's about, I don't even really want to go into what it's about specifically, because there's a couple of twists and turns throughout the movie that I think are really, if you haven't seen it, are really quality to find out about the first time around. But basically, there's a series of races in this small town. You have this bully played to perfection by Nick Cassavetes. Just like, just brutal and brooding and everything you would not want to come across in another human being. He's just the perfect villain. And he's basically got this scam going on in the small town where he forces people to race for pink slips. And he's got this gang of really colorful weirdos that follow him around. One of whom is played by Clint Howard with his eraser head haircut.
A wraith, man! A ghost! An evil spirit, and it ain't cool!
And he forces people to race for pink slips, and then he'll do whatever he can to win, and he'll steal their cars. And he's very possessive of this girl who lives in town. They're not dating. She wants nothing to do with him. But there's just something weird about their relationship where she can't seem to get away from him. And the new kid in town is Charlie Sheen, and he wants nothing more than to be with this girl, and you can't figure out what the deal is with this guy. And then at the same time, there's this mysterious kind of black race car that keeps showing up whenever these guys are racing, and one by one starts to take out members of this gang. Now, the car itself in the film, now first of all, like, it's just a balls-out entertaining sci-fi film with street racing elements, which the mashup of those two things in and of itself is worth the price of admission. But the car itself was actually a concept car called the Dodge M4S, which was a car that they were working on with Chrysler as a prototype for a new Indy car. So it has this legitimacy to it where it's not just a prop. Like, it's an honest to goodness futuristic car, you know, in 1986. And the things that it does in the movie are pretty spectacular. Do you need to pause it? And there is actually a bit of controversy here in that we do see the driver of this car. So, you know, to a certain extent, you might wonder, well, all these other movies are about either completely driverless evil cars or at least vehicles that we never see the driver. So the assumption is still there that it's driverless. And in this movie, yeah, we do see the driver of the car, but the driver is wearing this like motorcycle / spacesuit that really creates like a shadowy foreboding. Like, we never really get a sense of who he is. And he's just sort of this, like the title suggests, he is in fact a wraith. And I think the reason I love this movie so much is, like, for all of its 80s campiness and all of its, you know, Charlie Sheen heartthrob stuff, it works so well as a revenge film. I mean, this car, so this Dodge Interceptor is this silent, angry engine, and it, you know, it's got these tinted windows, and it's like it's just like this vengeance chariot, and it the way that it dispatches people with just sort of this wanton abandon and this like supernatural ability to repair itself, it really adds a sort of like sci-fi horror element to what started off as an action movie. And it worked, like, it starts to mishmash all of these things and do it so well. And then on top of all that, it has that bizarre 80s trope where it seems like an entire town run by teenagers. There's very little adult involvement at all. In fact, one of the few adults we see in the movie, aside from 27-year-old teenage Nick Cassavetes, is Randy Quaid, who's playing this, like...
Randy Quaid.
Who, despite the fact that he is irrepentantly Randy Quaid, is playing this, like, hard...
Why would you... If you were Randy Quaid, why would you ever be anything else?
I don't know. That's a good question. Ask Dennis Quaid
back,
that question.
Back in the 90s, me and my buddies had a running gag where, you know, we'd be watching a movie and it was like, you know what this movie needs?
Randy Quaid.
Randy Quaid.
I don't think people have really said that about a lot of films, but I will say that he really does pull off the sort of, like, hard-boiled, I'm sick of all this bullshit detective who is not only trying to bust this bizarre vengeance rider, but also the entire Cassavetes gang at the same time. And the stunts in this movie are intense and to the point of being irresponsible. And unfortunately, that turned out to be the case, as there was an accident on set that ended up costing a stuntman his life. But I got to say, like, for that sacrifice, the film is really elevated to something truly spectacular just by the stunts and the, like...
It's too less of the Twilight Zone, you know.
Yeah, you know. Wow.
Too soon?
Oi.
Too soon?
Little too soon. Little too soon. But on top of that, you have a great soundtrack, just like this 80s powerhouse soundtrack of like Ozzy Osbourne and Robert Palmer and Motley Crue. And it's just like all of these things convalesce into a film that I think is skipped over a little bit just because it's like, oh, it's a Charlie Sheen movie. Oh, he's trying to get the girl. Oh, he's a race car driver. It's like, no, none of that is really what's going on in this movie. It's really about where the hell did this car come from? Why does this driver have a shotgun the size of a fishing pole? And are these bad guys, you get to a point where you're kind of afraid for the bad guys. Like, you realize none of you are going to survive. Like, it becomes a Death Wish movie on wheels by the end of it.
The Wraith. If you've done nothing wrong, you've got nothing to fear.
It's The Crow.
It kind of is. And I love the ever-living hell out of this movie. And I think more people need to see it.
Yeah, the reason I haven't been talking too much is I have I saw it when it, you know, in the early days, just after it came out. And really liked it, but it's one that I haven't seen since. And it shows up on Netflix every once in a while, and I've had it in my Netflix queue forever, but it's never the right night for it. And just sitting here talking to you about it, I'm like, shit, I really need to watch that again.
Yeah.
And, cause I remember liking it quite a bit, but it just, it was of the list of movies we're talking about tonight. Like all the other ones I've seen recently, this one is, I haven't, and it's kind of a crime that I haven't.
Yeah, but this again, all of these movies, you know, they have varying levels of, I think, legitimate quality, but all of them have a special place in our hearts, and I think all of them again speak to just the fear of one, the fear of a machine that is ubiquitous in our everyday lives now, but is also very, very dangerous. And the fact that, you know, we could be lost to it without even trying, without any malicious intent at all. And of course, you know, taking that piece of technology that is so dangerous and giving it, is making it sentient and giving it malicious intent is horrifying. And then of course, just the overall fear of, us getting to like it's basically like the Prometheus, or Icarus. It's like the Icarus thing. It's like eventually with technology, we're going to fly a little bit too close to the sun, and there won't be an app to fix it, and our wings will melt. And I have lost the thread of what I was talking about, but that's fine. But killer car movies, hooray!
Hooray!
Vroom, vroom.
Yeah.
So the junk food pairing this week, this is a little bit of a stretch, but it's a personal one, so I had to go with it. I'm going to go with an ice cold mug of root beer, because when I was a kid, the only place to go for a great frosty mug of root beer was we had this little A&W like drive-in diner down the street from us.
I grew up with one of those nearby.
Yeah, and it's like I have therefore always associated the taste of real frosty, you know, mug root beer with being in the car. I can never not I can never really have a mug of root beer without being in the car. Like, it just doesn't feel right to me. And that association has lasted to this day. And, you know, unfortunately, we don't get very many. Like, we have, like, Sonic.
I was going to say, you know, but... Sonic Chili Cheese Footlong was what I was thinking you were going to go with, because that seems to be the, you know, you pull up and they bring you out this big disgusting pile of stuff that you're going to eat anyway. Actually, like if I were doing it, you know, the chili cheese tots is the way I would go.
Sonic.
Sonic's chili cheese tots, and maybe put those on the side of a chicken fried steak burger.
Mm-hmm. That's not bad.
But this being so Americana, the chili cheese footlong is kind of the go-to that I would kind of pair up with this, like pull into a Sonic and sit there and have the girl come out and bring you the tray of stuff and sit there and eat there at the Sonic and get chili all over your car. And that is what tonight feels like to me.
Indeed. Well, that's going to do it for Junk Food Cinema this week. Thank you so much for joining us. Please remember to follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. You can also like us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And please do use our Amazon link. Links, plural.
Links, plural.
Links, plural. And also want to remind you once again, July 4th, we will be in Minneapolis, Minnesota for Convergence.
Minnesota.
And we will be doing a live Junk Food Cinema there, both for the peeps in attendance, and we'll be broadcasting that live as well. So mark your calendars for that one. And you can find me online on Twitter at Bri Guy Salisbury, on Facebook, facebook.com/Brian Salisbury Critic. What about you, Cargill?
You can find me at Massaworm, MassaWyrm on Twitter, or at facebook.com/Massaworm. Or you can be kind and check out my new book, Queen of the Dark Things, available wherever you buy books.
Right on. And then, of course, you can find us on iTunes and Stitcher, all our previous episodes. Go there, give us a 5-star rating, leave a review, why don't you? And until next time, for Cargo, this is Brian reminding you that the next time you look at a KFC double down, slow down and ask yourself and ponder sincerely, who made who?